Did this May 17th hearing give us any indication of how fair the judges will be in ruling on Mumia's case?
It's always hard to telegraph what a judge might go, what direction they might go. But I think from the questioning, it would be fair to say that they were very concerned about the legality of the jury verdict form and also the legality of the prosecutor at Abu Jamal's trial, his statement about appeal after appeal, which lessened the jury's responsibility in setting the death penalty. So based on that, I think Abu Jamal's death sentence will continue to be set aside. It's not clear which way they may rule on the jury discrimination issue. They seem to be very concerned about it. These three judges have participated in rulings over the last couple of years where they have found that that type of jury discrimination exists in Philadelphia and have ordered new proceedings based on that. But it's really hard to say which way they're going to go with the Abu Jamal case. I would hope that they would remand it back to the district court. There was a lot of questioning about how big the jury pool was and when certain things were made in terms of objections. The prosecutor tried to contend that there wasn't any objections made in a timely fashion. However, the failure to do that was a result of the ineffective assistance of Abu Jamal's trial attorney, and the prosecutors have been successful over the years in getting courts to say that that's no big deal, that Abu Jamal's attorney was incompetent. So the failures of the attorney at trial and the shenanigans of prosecutors on appeal are now conspiring against Abu Jamal having the full measure of his legal rights on appeal.
Okay. Now, the appeal after appeal comment, did McGill make that in both the guilt phase and the penalty phase?
Well, it was in, my understanding, it was in the penalty phase where he was asking for the death penalty. And as a part of asking for the death penalty, he was trying to say, you know, give me the death penalty, but here's a way that you can do it without really bothering your conscience. You know, since there's going to be appeal after appeal, you can just slap the death penalty on this guy and somebody else will take care of it. So it's my understanding that it was in the penalty phase.
Does this court have the authority to just give Mumia a new trial based on the Batson claim, or do they have to send it back to the district court no matter what?
Well, technically, this court has the power to do whatever it wants. I mean, it could say that, you know, what we've read in the briefs and what we know about this case, it was so outrageous, let him go. That'll never happen. They could, yes, grant a new trial. But courts usually, and particularly appeals courts, they usually try to do the minimum that they feel is necessary to achieve justice. So I think what will happen is that they'll send it back to the trial judge, which is called remand, send it back to Judge Yon, and have him conduct a full evidentiary hearing on the Batson issue, where they would be able to put McGill on the stand, where they would be able to bring in evidence related to that and then have Yon rule on it, and then it'll probably be appealed back up to the Third Circuit. But if there's a full evidentiary hearing and evidence can be presented, then evidence would be presented that during a six-year period, I think it was a six-year period that encompassed the Abu Jamal trial, McGill used, I think, about 76% of his strikes against black people. And I think while a lot at the May 17th trial revolved around the statistics, you know, did he use 10 of 15 strikes or, you know, 11 of 20 or whatever, whatever. I think some of the most compelling evidence was some things that Robert Bryant said when he was indicating the disparities in questions that McGill was asking black jurors versus white jurors, which would indicate that he was clearly focusing in on racial considerations. And then also there was a statement made by Robert Bryant about something that happened in the courtroom during the trial when a black judge came in and sat down, and McGill made reference to it. Oh, I think black jurors would know that this is a black judge sitting in the back of the courtroom. So clearly, you know, black people were on his mind. The likelihood, given the anonymity of judges, and the fact that they're not in the public eye like a councilman or a mayor, or even a DA, the DA, not the assistant district attorneys, it's highly unlikely that black jurors would have known who this guy is, but for McGill pointing it out. So yeah, there were clearly, you know, racial, there was clearly race on his mind when he was conducting not only the jury selection, but during the trial itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Robert Bryant made the statement about how, at the very end, his conclusion about how could this be the exception to the rule, you know, in a case as racially charged as Mumia's, you know, how could this be the exception to the rule if the DA was doing this in every other case?
Yeah, I think that was perhaps his strongest argument. And it came at a very good time because that was the last thing that the judges heard, you know,
right,
when he made that. But that I think that goes right to the core of it. How is it that there can be discrimination in jury selection that federal district courts and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals have found in Philadelphia that have occurred before Mumia's trial, during the time of his trial, and after his trial, in his case, be the exception? That argument can be extended a little further. How is it that people can be framed in Philadelphia before, during, and after Mumia's trial, and he be the exception that is not framed? In his case, being unusual in that he was accused of killing a police officer, he was hoisted by police and prosecutors as this wild black radical, this is a white police officer, so why would they frame mob murderers, why would they frame arsonists, why would they frame people who, you know, kill doctors, and not frame someone who killed a cop? It just doesn't make any sense. I was thinking, actually, this morning, in the late 70s, I have to go back, you know, go through some of my materials and my records, but Philadelphia police framed a retarded man in Kensington named Reds Wilkinson. I can't remember his first name, but his nickname was Reds. His last name was Wilkinson. He was accused of firebombing a house that some Puerto Ricans had moved into. And this was back in a time when, you know, when somebody non-white moved on a white block in places like Kensington or South Philadelphia, there was always some racial trouble. And police arrested this guy, Wilkinson, beat the stuffings out of him, got him to confess, took him to trial, convicted him, and he was sent off to prison for life imprisonment. It subsequently came out that he was, you know, the confession was beaten out of him, and cops covered up the fact that he was innocent and he was beaten into this confession. And interestingly enough, the cops who did this were put on trial in federal court and convicted. And they were sent off to prison. And I think it was in 1980 when their attorneys, who included Richard Sprague, I think it was Richard Sprague or Chuck Peruta, Charles Peruta, the father. And again, I had to go back through and check my notes. But they went to court and said, "Oh, Your Honor, these men have suffered enough. They've served 12 months in jail. This is horrible for police officers. We think that they're remorseful and they're sorry." And the judge let them off. You know, this guy Wilkerson served more time in jail than they did. So it's just a travesty of justice, you know, that repeats itself time and time and time again. It's just horrible. And then here you have Abu Jamal, who's been, you know, sitting in a death row cell for 25 years for something that, if in fact he did it, it doesn't rise to any more than like third degree murder. He should have been out with time served.